How are you?
We're going to start the meeting, even though we don't have a quorum yet, but we're trying to catch up. So, Assistant Commissioner Coleman, if you would wish to start, we'll get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Lauren Coleman. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care at the Department of Human Services. Where we left off was talking about the nursing facility rate proposal, but I would like to make a comment before I go back into the materials here. I attended the hearing yesterday afternoon on autism, which was really a very thoughtful hearing and prompted me to kind of replay my presentation of the autism proposal, and I don't think I did a very good job in really expressing what the new services are that will be available to children with autism spectrum disorder. So I've asked staff to put together the policy and the clinicians to put together in a very clear manner what those services would be, and we will get that to you very, very shortly so that it's clear that there is something different that's being proposed within that budget activity.
We'll be looking forward to that, yeah, because I think autism is going to get a lot of attention this year.
I agree, Mr. Chair. So where we left off is talking about the nursing facility rate increase and quality add-on. I'll draw your attention to let me get myself organized here. On page 13 of the governor's budget, the suspension of the alternative payment system inflation for nursing facilities, both on the operating rate and on the property rate. So those in combination are in current law, and we are suspending those two provisions in order to pay that almost identical sum of money to nursing facilities via the proposal that I was discussing yesterday with you, the base rate increase plus the quality add-on. So that's how the funding occurs, and this is already in law.
So Commissioner Coleman, that means that the net spending on nursing homes is really not going up,
Mr. Chair,
based on current law?
Mr. Chair, that would be correct in accordance with current law.
Okay.
So then I'll move to the home and community-based pay-for-performance initiative, which you'll find a fast fact sheet on number 20. And this initiative is really introducing some new ideas to the home and community-based sector of our long-term care system, much of which is patterned off of what we have learned around improving quality and leveraging the expertise of the providers and then providing incentives and performance bonuses for those who achieve those objectives. So there's really a few main points that I like to make about this proposal. One, we're looking at this as a four-year initiative, and so the process requires us to spend the first couple years developing an agreed-upon set of quality measures by which we would then be able to distribute rate increases based upon that performance. And so in the first 2 years, I'll just say it out loud, there is no rate increase for this sector of the long-term care system. There is an opportunity, though, and it'll be on a competitive basis, by which we would do a PIP program, a performance improvement project and program patterned off of what we've done with nursing homes for the last several years. by which providers identify an area of their operation. It could be clinical, it could be environmental, but certainly something that's going to improve their performance and improve the quality of life of the people they're serving. So they identify in their own organization what they propose to improve. They submit that to the department. We evaluate those proposals on a competitive basis. We then select those based upon the elements that are being proposed and the amount of money that we have available. And we create a contract with that entity with objective, measurable outcomes. And if they achieve those outcomes, then they get the payment associated with what we've negotiated. We have seen documentable evidence that where nursing facilities have participated in their performance improvement programs, that their quality score has increased. The uniqueness is we are not declaring what we want each provider to work on. They get to self-select what area of their service do they feel they want to demonstrate improvement, and then we work with them to document that. In the interim, and I mentioned it yesterday, the development of a home and community-based report card is critical for us then to document the quality being delivered and the information available to the public. So in the next 2 years, in 16 and 17, we would have a pay-for-performance proposal that would acknowledge the quality achievements in the home community-based sector. So I ask you to look at this as kind of a four-year project where we're introducing the concept of recognizing performance as a mechanism to receive a rate increase for the home community.
Commissioner Coleman, the money spent in the first biennium, is that all within your department, or does that go to nursing homes or long-term care as well?
Mr. Chair, this is this money is intended for the home and community-based system, which is part of my administration, as well as ICFDDs.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, and I guess we don't have luxurious amounts of time to go into some of this, but can you just give me an idea? We have a little time or not tomorrow, Mr. Chair?
Well,
okay. Can you tell me the rate range of increases you're thinking for 16 and 17? Is that a one or a two that you're thinking?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it averages 2%, around 2% based upon trying to make it comparable to the inflation factor that we're working with on nursing facilities.
And Mr. Chair, and we can...
Representative Aver.
Thanks. We can spend time offline talking about this, and I'm sure this will draw some interest from people. If there's some kind of, so anybody could participate in this, any provider, and they could kind of pick and choose how they want to improve, and you go like, oh, that's a good plan, or do you have like an array of services you're going to try to drive this? It seemed like it was kind of laissez-faire, like, oh, we can work on some things or not, but I presume you have a more of a menu of things you're going to want them to measure.
Mr. Chair, Representative, correct. I mean, we have some experience on some of the proposals that we worked with nursing facilities, and again, although they may not be identical, some of the demonstrated practices that they've worked on are very clinical. Some are more quality of life, working on minimizing noise in facilities or improving call light response, some of those kinds of things. On the home and community-based side, there would be a different kind of menu, but again, we're asking the providers in that sector to identify what areas. We will give them some thoughts, some domains that they might want to work on. It could be the use of improvement in the use of restraints or the use of community activities or the interaction with families. I mean, there's a range of elements that are at the disposal. I would not say it's laissez-faire. It's really purposeful to improve the quality of life of the individuals who are in the programs.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just follow up. Well, that sounds, you know, very interesting, and I appreciate the push to quality. Maybe I think we're due for a visit anyway with you and I and some of your staff on men choices and other things, so we can take this up offline. But maybe you can just pencil that in sometime. Thanks.
Commissioner Coleman.
Okay, moving on, we have the quality initiative, positive practice and behavior safeguards and supports. I'm sorry, I missed one. Waiver management improvements. What this proposal is doing is recognizing that we have very large disability waiver programs now, and there are ways that we have identified that we can improve the effectiveness of those disability waivers. What we are proposing to do here is to provide authority for the department to more actively manage the use of the waiver funds among counties, so that in working with a county who may not need as much resource during the course of a year, we would have the authority to redirect some of those funds to other counties where there are greater needs. We would work with counties and providers to develop additional services such as shared living models, family respite care, things of that nature, so that we can again make the best use of the disability waiver dollars that we have available. So we need some additional authority and some additional tools to do so. We are also proposing that individuals who are eligible for the Money Follows the Person initiative, which is another program which is directed at moving people from institutions or group homes or congregate settings into community-based settings, that they would have a priority for movement into homes of their own or the community. Much of what we are attempting to do here is a result of learning through our waiver review plan, program. We have a program where we actually go to each county and tribe to review their management practices around the waivers. And that's documented. Those reviews are on the web. We compare various cohorts of counties to see how many, how good a job are people doing in terms of managing costs, managing community inclusion, managing quality. So much of what we're basing this on is what we're learning as we go out into the field and work with the counties and tribes to learn what we can improve in the management of the waivers.
Representative Abler.
I don't have a comment for everything, but as this goes, I support what you're trying to do here personally. But I'm concerned you're going to find yourself rewarding a wasteful county and penalizing a more frugal county. And I hope as you do this analysis that it's done, you understand exactly what I'm saying. I hope as you do the analysis you would point out to a county who's been much more, you know, well, I'll just use the word wasteful, but just at least less focused in spending some of their monies, that they might lose some of their money too if they're not going to be as focused as some really stellar counties that have more people served with less dollars and more focused reassessment plans and moving them to the least restrictive, more independent sites. So that's I'll try to help you with that if I can. But otherwise, really bad things can happen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I concur. We don't want to create unintended consequences. We don't want to disturb county decision-making, but we're also trying to acknowledge that as the state, We need some flexibility. I think we have to work with counties. There should be no surprises. They shouldn't wake up one morning and find that they've lost some resources that they were counting on for later on in the year or something like that. So there is a delicacy to manage this, but we believe we can actively manage it better. Okay, moving on. We're now on Quality Initiative, Positive Practice and Behavior Safeguards and Supports. This is a very timely topic, very current topic. There's been a lot of work over the last year or two on working on provider standards. And part of those provider standards is really looking at what are the positive practices, what are the behavioral safeguards that can be can be implemented by the entire provider sector to eliminate the use of restraints and seclusion, if not minimize it. I'll go to the extreme and eliminate first, because I think that ought to be the goal. But again, I have to defer to the clinicians as to some of those judgments. But what we are saying here, though, is that there is a body of knowledge that can be employed by all providers in our system that is more positive rather than punitive. Many providers have demonstrated an ability to achieve that, but some need more training, some need more guidance, more technical assistance, and so what this proposal is doing is to recognize that it's easy for us to just promulgate the rules and say thou shalt do this, that, or the other thing, but we also have a responsibility to work at promulgating those rules and then train, coach, teach, and provide that technical assistance across our system. So that's why there are some resources available here, as well as collecting the data. Again, we're very focused on managing by data, so we need to monitor and manage these activities on behalf of our program participants.
Members, we now have a quorum, so I will officially call the meeting to order. And we don't have minutes ready. We'll have those for the at the next meeting. So the meeting's in order, and you can continue, Assistant Commissioner Coleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm now on the bottom of page 14, Waiver Provider Standards Phase 2. And there's also a fast fact sheet, number 22. Many of you will recall that we were before you last year talking about waiver standards for our programs. A brief background, as we eliminate the county contracts in accordance with our compliance agreement with CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, we needed to insert standards for the providers that are in our system. We relied upon counties to do this previously. Now, as the state is taking responsibility for the contracting, this comes along with that. We've worked with a variety of work groups to identify what those standards ought to look like. Some examples that may help you further understand what we mean, but what are the requirements for staff orientation? What are the requirements for staff training? What are the requirements for qualified professionals? And some of those elements that providers need to demonstrate. What are the policies and practices that need to be in place in each of our provider settings? And this implements those standards, again, in accordance with our agreement with the federal government. There's another component here that I'm not going to talk about today, but is certainly something that will will need to be debated. Many of these providers have not previously been licensed, and this would require them to obtain a license. In accordance with that license would be a fee. And Jerry Kerber, who will appear before you at some point in time, will explain the fee structure from the licensing component of the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health. Another element here, which is the substantial amount of this money, is, again, training. If we're going to have standards within our waiver programs for these licensed providers, we feel that there needs to be training made available. And so there is a College of Direct Support. It's an online training module where we will make that available to direct care workers so they understand what their obligations and what their practices should look like as they comply with the 245D standards.
Commissioner, is this an area that there's a certain amount of fraud involved with the billing? Or is it, are you just focused on the quality of care that's being given?
Mr. Chair, this is focused on improving the quality and the compliance with the program requirements. It is not focused on billing mechanisms.
And Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. And Mr. Chair, there'll be more discussion about this 245D thing, and I was working with this last year. And I'm just a little concerned about the level of fees that are being brought forward, which I know is not Mr. Coleman's department, but they're going to be quite a burden on some of these providers. Some of them have never been licensed before, and they were serving just fine. And for the members, as this gets brought forward, we're going to revisit again this year and in the policy committee probably primarily, and then it's going to show up here because there's money. But it's really important that we establish a high enough bar, but we don't injure the fragility of some of the economies of these small providers, and most of whom were fine before this, and the complaint-driven system drove almost no complaints. So I was hoping at the end that we could actually have a uniform, nice standard that would apply and would be easy to hit for people who are doing the right thing. So that's maybe an editorial comment, but it's going to come up, so I just wanted to alert members. This is something new, and the fee structure is new, and there's no new money in the bill for the providers to pay this, and that's a function of all kinds of decisions that will be made. That will be our decision later about how we choose to spend our money. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll now turn to enhance audit activity resources for nursing facilities. It's on page 15 of the governor's changes. There have been quite a number of reporting and policy changes around nursing facilities over the last number of years. We do believe that there are some limited but still important misreporting, certainly not accusing facilities of intentionally doing so, but it's complex. And whether Medicare is being billed first, which is a requirement, and some of those kinds of elements. So this is a resource to the Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division that would provide some additional audit capacity to look at the reporting of nursing facilities and correct, make adjustments where those are warranted. The next item is the restoration of the Plan Closure Rate Adjustment Authority. For a number of years, the state of Minnesota paid nursing facilities if they voluntarily chose to close some of their nursing home beds or an entire facility. The net effect to the state budget was positive because people would be served in less expensive environment. That was repealed a couple years ago. As we've watched the evidence, as we've watched the the closure program. We're now revisiting that topic and believing that there are some limited situations where facilities would still like to close beds. We should incent that. We should acknowledge that. We should pay them that closure rate, and it still saves the state money. So this is trying to revisit that topic and reintroduce the plan closure rate adjustment policy. The next item is the HIV rebate adjustment. We provide support to people living with AIDS, HIV, for pharmaceutical purchases, insurance purchases, social service purchase services, etc. What this fund is addressing is kind of a, we have multiple resources that are coming into helping us manage services for this population. We have some federal funds, we have a state appropriation, we also have what's known as the rebate program, where we receive rebates from pharmaceutical companies. That rebate program has really been quite successful. And as we've looked at the amount of resources projected to be needed for continuing the services to this population, we are acknowledging that this sum of money that the state is spending from the general fund is not necessary for the next year. We will still have a sufficient amount of funds to continue to provide the same services that we're providing today. It doesn't eliminate the appropriation into the future. It still preserves it. But for this fiscal year, we're suspending that that direct appropriation.
Commissioner, could you just clarify briefly, people on AIDS, are they all eligible for Medicare now, or what? Or SSI, I'm trying to remember what.
Mr. Chair, some are eligible for Medicare, and we certainly direct them to that program to enroll. Some are eligible for medical assistance or Medicaid, and we try to help them apply for medical assistance. So we look to other other funding sources where their needs can be met also.
And Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Coleman, I was just noticing that it speaks here about double appropriation for supplemental insurance premiums. And so I had somewhat the same question as Representative Huntley. What is that? Are we helping people get an MCHA? And I'm kind of curious if that's what, that's the kind of thing that it is, which would make sense, what's going to happen to that now that those people presumably are going to be in the pool with everybody else?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we help people select Medicare Part D plans. We direct people and work with the MSHA program. It's still a bit unclear. We know that a limited number of people who are receiving support in this program will be eligible January 1, 2014 for expansion of Medicaid and or some supplemental support. But it's still a limited number of people, and it's still somewhat unclear. So we're taking a conservative approach to suspending the state appropriation so that we don't fall short 2 or 3 years down the road and then have to revisit this. So we're just taking the 1 year. Now, the double appropriation, that was simply an error that we're correcting from the last biennial budget. It has no impact on the fund. It's just correcting that the accounting somehow got an error in it.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. And Mr. Coleman, so How much money do we budget then for these supplemental insurance premiums? I don't know if you have that kind of information at the tip of your fingers here.
Yeah,
but I'd like to know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't have that exact because there are a variety of purchases that are made in this fund, but we'll get you that detail.
Thank you.
Commissioner.
And with that, I believe I've concluded my pages.
Okay, any questions for Commissioner Coleman? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony, and we'll move on to the next person.
Thank you.
And while we're waiting for Sullivan Sutton to come down, I'd just like to recognize former Representative Larry Hosh, who used to sit over there for about 6 years. Welcome. It's Commissioner Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. And I have 8 items to talk about today. 4 of them are reduction items, and 4 of them are investment items. You also have, I believe, a handout being passed around that shows a further breakdown of a couple of the individual components that I'll talk about as we get to the items and with respect to particularly access to quality care for children, as well as some recommendations regarding the Minnesota Family Investment Program. So there are a number of recommendations in the governor's proposal that will help prevent child abuse and neglect and focus on the safe and healthy development of children and supporting families' efforts to safely care for their children, help parents, particularly teen parents, complete their education. As well as the first item I'm going to talk about is actually having to do with adults. So I want to point that out. And that's the top of page 16, Reform 2020, having to do with housing stability services demonstration. This is actually a part of Reform 2020, and this is contingent on receipt of a Medicaid waiver that the department has requested approval. What this proposal does is seek to demonstrate that providing housing stability services will help people live stably in the community and help thousands of individuals while also saving money. The proposal here would be to allow for the use of Medicaid funds to provide tenancy supports, community and community living assistance that we believe is an appropriate expenditure under the federal program. And the estimation is that we would serve approximately 3,000 people per month and over a period of about 5 years save $17 million in state general fund expenditures. I should mention you have it fast back to page 25 is more information on that recommendation. The second item I want to talk about is increasing access to quality child care for children with high needs, and the fast fact page 27 corresponds to this proposal. This proposal with respect to child care does a number of things. First, the recommendation is to simplify the current rate structure and to set updated rates for some providers. So we're looking to move the rate structure. Currently, there's about 2,000 different rate cells in the child care program. We're working to reduce that and have a more clustered approach based on population, and wanted to make sure that no provider rates were reduced, so there is some increase here. We also have a recommendation to add to pay higher rates for child care for those child care providers who are part of Parent Aware, which is the state's quality rating system for child care providers. And the recommendation is that the providers who are part of the system and are rated at the 3-star level would receive a 15% increase over the maximum rates, which is consistent with how accredited providers are currently dealt with. And then the recommendation is that for providers who are at the 4-star rating, that the differential be a 20% increase in the rating.
Representative Moran has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And good morning, Commissioner. So I've been struggling to get some clarity around access to this proposal here. based on the governor's proposal of investing $44 million into access to a quality daycare center. And so I was just reading here that access does not really mean that there would be more available spaces, but more is based on more providers getting the rating from Parent Aware. Can you clarify that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Moran, that is correct. What we're trying to do is move children who are on the child care assistance program into higher quality care. And part of this recommendation is to allow for the higher rates for those children who are being served by programs who are rated at the 3 or 4 star rating. I should also mention that the governor's recommendation in this part of the budget are very complementary with some of the recommendations that he has made for investments that show up in the Department of Education's budget as well. And then there you see recommendations regarding early childhood scholarships with the idea of helping families be able to have access to both scholarships as well as for those families who are on child care assistance to be able to braid those resources together so that they have more ability to enroll their children in high quality care.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm not familiar what Parent Aware, what would qualify a center to qualify? I mean, what would be the criteria that they would need to go through to qualify?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moran, Parent Aware is a quality rating system that addresses, and we can certainly give you more information about this, but the training of providers, the qualifications of providers, and the types of care as well as the setting of the program. So we have two ways of rating programs. So, for example, and we're rolling out the quality rating system over a period of several years. There was a pilot that was done in a number of counties several years ago. So this is a voluntary rating system that's going over a time. So for programs that are currently, for example, child care centers that may be accredited or family providers who are accredited, they have an opportunity for what we call an accelerated rating, and that is based on their position as an accredited organization provider, as well as some training components. They are able to pretty quickly be rated as a 4-star provider. And then there is another process for both family, child care, and other centers to go through to be rated. And the idea is to help providers move from a 1-star rating to a 2-star rating, 3-star rating, and 4-star rating. There are also, as a part of this, resources available to help providers access or participate in training or get resources they need to help them improve. So it's a continuous improvement of our child care system, and we'd be happy to get you more detailed information.
Okay.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have two things I'm struggling with. It is the access to the scholarships. In some of my research, it seemed as though the scholarships will cover high-quality rating child care centers. Is that only?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, the child care, the scholarships that are currently available, there is, this is through the Department of Education, up to $4,000 per eligible child in fiscal year 2013, which is about 460 scholarships. What the Department of Education will tell you that, and I should also mention that the governor has recommended that the biennial funding for early child scholarships be increased to about $50 million, which is about 10,000 scholarships. And what the Department of Education will tell you that they are currently, under the existing scholarships, only able to fund about 1.5% of children who would meet other eligibility criteria. And the proposal would increase that to about 12% of the eligible children. And in order to be eligible, the scholarships are available for children who are part of the Parent Aware system in 3 or 4 star rated program. They have an income less than or equal to 47% of the median income, and have kids between the ages of 3 and 4.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the scholarships will be available for kids who are participating in the Parent Aware programs. So my question is, so my comment is sometimes, for instance, if I am a mother who has 2 children, 3 children, I'm working or in school, I'm on a bus, and I have a daycare provider in my neighborhood, it may be easier for me to access that child care provider who may not be parent aware and may not be rated, but it's more convenient. I feel, I know, I'm comfortable, I feel really good about leaving my children with that provider, but I'm not able to access the scholarship to provide the service for my child to participate. And I think sometimes in our ability to create programs and make opportunities available, we are creating those barriers to parents who need that type of support. And so as we look at access, you know, who would be able to access these scholarships, and would it be become a bigger part of that waiting list? We have a tons of parents who are on this huge waiting list who may not be able to access a parent aware child care provider but need the service.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I appreciate the concerns, and we'll share those with our colleagues over at Education. I should also mention that as a part of the Race to the Top grant that was awarded to Minnesota about a year ago, there's about $10 million available in additional scholarship money that will be for those areas of the state that are participating in the Race to the Top. So that includes Itasca County, the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, the Northside Achievement Zone in Minneapolis, and the White Earth Reservation.
Commissioner. Oh, wait a minute. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, for someone new to the committee, can you tell me if under children with high needs, does it include kids with special needs as well as low-income families?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
It does. Thank you.
A couple of other components I want to mention with respect to the child care proposal is, one is ensuring that teen parents who are pursuing education have access to child care. Currently, teen parents who are not on MFIT may be placed on the basic sliding fee waiting list, which is a significant issue. Although the numbers are not large, we believe it's important that teen parents have access immediately to child care if they're pursuing education and staying in school. And then a couple of other components we looked at having to do with trying to make sure that we are not creating more instability or trauma for kids who are in care because of the actions or inactions of a parent or a provider. So we have a provision here that would increase the continuity of care by allowing a 30-day reinstatement period for families served by the basic sliding fee, that, so that children will be allowed to remain in high-quality care and allow parents time to get paperwork in and that sort of thing as there's changes in their schedules. And then there's also a recommendation regarding aligning the disqualification periods and withholding authorizations, basically to make sure that the provider, that we don't abruptly remove kids from care as providers are doing things that they need to do to be in compliance with requirements. The next item that I would like to talk about is the North Star Care for Children, and the Fast Fact page 29 is the corresponding detail there. What the North Star proposal is a actually a combining of what is a simplification and combining what is what are currently three separate programs that support children in out-of-home placement. Currently, we have a foster care program that supports kids in temporary care. We have a relative custody assistance program that's provided to relatives who accept permanent legal responsibility for children who've been in foster care, and an adoption assistance program that provides adoption assistance to families who adopt special needs children from the foster care system. The way those programs are currently structured is there is an automatic cost of living increase in the foster care program. There is not that kind of increase in the adoption assistance or relative custody assistance. And what we see is that over time, the disparity between foster care and the other programs continues to increase. So, for example, if a child is in foster care and is not able to return safely to their families, the counties work to establish permanency for those children with another family, either relatives or adoption assistants. But the resources that are available for caring for that child when they move from a foster care status to permanency with relatives or adoption assistance are about half of what's available to when the child's in foster care. And what we have seen is that that creates a barrier for a number of children moving to permanency. And the proposal that you will see before the committee in the weeks ahead is actually based on a demonstration program that we had under the Title 40 foster care program a number of years ago, where we were able to demonstrate that maintaining stability across the program, so maintaining the same level of benefits for those children, did increase the opportunity to provide permanency for children who might not otherwise have that. And what we saw through that demonstration was, particularly with respect to African American and American Indian children, we saw permanency where otherwise we might not have seen that. And there was a rigorous evaluation that was done of that demonstration. Now, what I will tell you is that the demonstration that we had maintained the level of benefit at the foster care rate. This proposal that you will see in the coming weeks does not do that. Ideally, we might like to do that, but that would cost about $47 million in general funds in the out years. And we did not think that that was something that we were likely to be able to afford. And so what we're trying to do is have an adjustment, kind of a one-time mid-course correction of the programs, so that on for children entering out-of-home care on or after January 1st, 2015, they would become a part of this new program. And we would not change the benefits or services for any kids who are currently in the foster care system, but we would target this program for kids entering care on or after, as I said, January 1st of 2015. And you will see more discussion of this as the governor's budget bill moves forward, but we really try to hold harmless children who are currently in the system. And what you will see in the proposal that you get is that for most children and families caring for their children, there will be an increase in benefit because of the new structure. But for a few, there's it won't be kids who are currently in the system, but there will be a reduction in a few situations. The other thing that you will see in the proposal is that we're recommending that the new benefit be available for kids as they move to permanency who are over 5 years of age. What we see is that under the current adoption assistance program, Minnesota is pretty successful at getting little kids adopted, and we think that that will continue, and that was a way to have to try to come up with a recommendation that would withstand some fiscal muster, so to speak. We also are recommending that there be a cost of living built into the new program so that there's incremental increases over time.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to say first that, you know, I think the move that you're making and to support kids who are in foster care, out-of-home placement, is a good move. And I strongly believe that kids should be in a permanent place. They should be in a stable environment. But at the same time, you know, I'm grappling with the 24-month period, because a lot of the guidelines that you currently have in place for parents to work towards reunifying themselves with their kids is in many ways, I would say, it's not appropriate. You know, you may have a parent who is struggling with drug addiction or whatever, and it may be a 6-month period, or that she needs to, or he or she may need to work towards getting herself clean and doing all the things they need to do under the guidelines of DHS. And, you know, that's a hard task. That could be a really, really hard task. And it may take 12 months. It may take 18 months. But in the meantime, you have this child who is in out-of-home placement, foster care, which is not a good place to be if at all. They should be with other family members, if at all possible. But at the same time, you have a parent who's trying to do the best that she can. And so I guess my hope is, that, you know, in 24 months, the child is gone. The child is no longer under her care. It's been adopted out to someone else. And we know that usually most kids, you know, they are attached to their mothers and their families, and they want that connection. And even years later, they're searching for those parents and those relatives. And so I was just thinking within this process, and maybe somewhere else in the work that you're going to do around reunifications with families, is how do we support the parents to get the parent to a place where they have the training, the tools, and support that they need to be reunified within a 24-month time period, or maybe longer if they need it, if they're making the best effort to do that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moran, couldn't agree more. We want children with their parents whenever that's possible. And one of the things you'll hear me talk about in a few minutes is some early intervention work to keep kids safely at home with their families and avoid the need for temporary foster care. We have seen a significant reduction in the number of children in foster care in Minnesota over the past 10 years, about 35% to 40% reduction, I believe, which we believe is a good thing. We also believe it's important that parents have access to the services they need and timely assessments. And so some of the work that has been done jointly, particularly with the judicial branch and the court system, is to make sure that when children are removed, that parents have access to the assessments and services that they need, whether they be chemical health or mental health, and that agencies are working diligently to help parents. And for those parents who are, in fact, working and doing what they need to be doing to be on the road to recovery, we would hope that the counties and the courts would recognize that, because that's the sort of thing that we do want to see. And at the same time, the federal government and the states have said when parents are not doing what they need to do, we need to make sure that kids don't grow up in foster care. That's why the federal law has some of those timelines for us.
Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and just a couple of short questions. I presume when the bill, this is just a summary, when the bill comes, we'll understand how the county funding interacts with all this. But is there a reason that it's 2015 and not 2014? Is that just because you haven't got the money to do it in 2015, but you'd rather do it in 2014?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, we did it in 2015 in order to have time to implement the changes, as well as give time for the system to get ready for the change. Because this is a significant change, moving from these three separate programs into one program. So that's a combination of those things.
So, Mr. Chair, so if you had you know, a couple more $1 million, you wouldn't like to advance it if you could?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, we always would like to do things sooner than we can. I think we would have some capacity issues. I'm looking at some of the folks that have worked on the details. We believe that 2015 is the most reasonable.
Thank you.
I think it's interesting. This is the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, but we've heard just now talk about the Education Department and talk about the Judiciary Service and how they interact, and can't separate those from what these particular individuals. Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's also interesting that Representative Abler, now that he doesn't have to pay for stuff,
right,
wants to offer it.
Commissioner, go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if there's not further questions on the North Star proposal, I will move forward to page 17. And now I want to talk about the Minnesota Family Investment Program. As you all know, the Minnesota Family Investment Program is Minnesota's program to move people from assistance to work. There are a number of components to the proposal before you. As you may know, over the years, the Minnesota Family Investment Program has been extremely complex for counties to administer. And what our proposal does is make recommendations to make the program less complicated and have services be more effective in terms of moving families to employment. We are proposing some structural foundations to lay a foundation for continued improvement with the understanding that we are in an environment of constrained resources. We recognize that. But I want to speak to you particularly about three components of the proposal here. One is the opportunity to request a federal waiver. Secondly, some recommendations regarding simplification of county administration of the program. And third, collaborating with the Minnesota Department of Health to more effectively serve teen parents. The complexities of the Minnesota Family Investment Program make it expensive to administer. Employment counselors tell us that they spend over half of their time doing simply paperwork to document compliance so that they can demonstrate people are in compliance with the federal work participation rates. We believe that it's important to refocus the program on outcomes and refocus the energy of employment counselors on doing what they do, doing what they're trained to do in terms of helping people really prepare for, apply for, and obtain employment. The federal waiver that we are interested in pursuing would allow Minnesota to replace that work participation federal process measure that currently governs the program that I mentioned to an outcome measure that would allow us to build a more results-focused program, and we're looking at the self-support index, which measures people who actually leave the program and get jobs. The federal process measure counts the number of parents and assistants who are in one of 12 activities that are recognized as work-related for at least 20 to 30 hours a week. Those activities may or may not lead to employment, and it's a lot about compliance. One of the things that I think it's important to recognize is that the work participation rate doesn't recognize people who leave the program because they have a job, and that's really what we want to focus on. We want to reinvigorate the focus on employment outcomes. The governor's budget proposal also includes strategic use of one-time funds to support the development of promising practices, including building on successful demonstrations to improve employment outcomes, particularly for African American and American Indian parents, and to work to replicate some work-study programs that were very successful in Kentucky and California. And hone successful models of paid work experience. And we believe about 640 families a year can be assisted with the paid work experience. As I mentioned, simplification of the program is critical. It costs about twice as much to administer the MFIP program at the county level as it does to administer the SNAP program, and we think it's because of the focus on some of the compliance issues. One of the things that we've also seen over the years is in order for the state to maintain compliance with work participation requirements, there's been a lot of creative work done. And in fact, we now have kind of, I think, three sub-programs in addition to the core MFIP program. One of those programs is the Work Benefit Program. And the Work Benefit Program provides $25 a month to people who leave assistance because they, in fact, have jobs. And Minnesota created that program in order to bring those people back into our work participation rate. And we believe that if we're able to pursue some changes, we can eliminate the work participation, the work benefit program, and do something different that would actually increase the number of dollars available to families who are, in fact, employed. We very strongly want to continue to reward people who are getting employment, but we think we can do it differently. One of the things that we propose as a part of this is to raise the income disregard to 50%. Currently, it's at 40%. If we increase the income disregard to 50%, that would be the same disregard that's applied to people who are on our unemployment insurance benefit program in Minnesota who also work part-time. So it would align the resources there. The other thing I should mention is that currently people that exit the MFIP program at 115% of poverty. When MFIP was first developed with the extensive field trials back in the late 80s, the exit level was at about 140% of poverty. By implementing this change and increase in the income disregard, it would bring the exit level about to 143%. It's not a lot of money in people's pockets. It would be about $38 a month instead of the $25 that currently is in the work benefit program. But we believe that rewarding the higher disregard would serve about 16,000 children and 7,400 families. You will also see in the department's policy bill a number of changes that are no cost proposals, but to increase some of the administrative relief to counties and frontline staff who administer this program. And then finally, the proposal focuses on serving teen parents differently. Currently, three quarters of teen parents on MFIP were on assistance when they were young children. And so we're hoping to change the trajectory of young mothers' lives and the lives of their children. And what we're hoping to do is
Did you say three quarters of the?
Yes. Three quarters of parents on MFIP were on assistance when they were young children. And what one of the things that we're looking at is evaluations of evidence-based home visiting programs show very strong promise in the ability to help young mothers graduate from high school and to improve the chances that their babies are healthy and meet important developmental milestones. So we're working in partnership with the Department of Health, and what we hope to do is solicit local county partnerships that would provide public health home visiting services as the primary service offered to teen parents on MFIP. This proposal does not seek new service funds. Our intent is to use one-time funds to help local partnerships get up and running in order to enroll teen parents on MFIP and home visiting programs that are already funded with the temporary assistance for needy families that you have allocated to the Department of Health. And what we hope to do is identify some willing partners in a handful of counties and look at if we do things different with teen parents, help to focus teen parents and encourage and support their continuing their education and graduating from high school, help to work to assure that their children have access to high-quality care, and we have a different outcome both in terms of the teen parent as well as her baby. This is not a large population, but we think it's an important population to focus on. There's about 1,200 minor parents who are on MFIP and about 3,800 parents who are 18 or 19 years old. Correction. Thanks. Of teen parents on MFIP, three quarters were on their parents were on assistance as children as well. So that's those are the recommendations in the MFIP area.
We have a question from
Thanks. In that outreach to teen parents, is there an effort to get education beyond the high school level? Because I just remember in 96 when the big changes took place, I was a legal aid lawyer at the time, and there was a significant education component. And I know over the years the opportunity to get more education has sort of decreased, and the focus on work has increased. And what we were seeing when it first came out was women going and getting nursing degrees and really taking actions that would sort of end the cycle of poverty in their families. And so I'm wondering, in the outreach that you're talking about to teen parents, is there a component that gets them beyond that high school degree, which maybe doesn't allow them to climb out of poverty and allow their kids to climb out of poverty in the long run?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's nothing here that would change the people's ability to pursue education under the existing MFIP program, but we would hope that in the interactions with teen parents that they would be encouraged to pursue additional education beyond high school the same way that a number of adults on the MFIP program are pursuing education to the extent that they're able to within the program. And one of the things that we hear from parents on the program. In fact, just last summer we met with a number of individuals who are on our MFIP program, and they very firmly told us of the importance of their pursuing their education, and particularly a four-year degree.
Forgetting the MFIP part of this, nobody that just has a high school degree is going to go out and earn a decent living without some kind of education after they get out of high school. And we have a question from Representative Lane and then Liebling.
You were talking about education under the MFIP programs. I understand 1 year under certain circumstances, maybe two. It's very limited. We've changed as Representative Hartman was mentioning, we've changed a lot the rules greatly. Getting education is not encouraged or helped, should I say, under the MFIP program. It's simply this. Try to get a job, show me that you're doing the hours to try to get a job. And even if they go to school, I think more than 1 year, they have to do 30 hours of work study or volunteer or something besides. So raise a family, do this, get some more money, go to school. It's really impossible. A 4-year degree under MFIB is impossible, as far as I understand. And I would really like to look further into revisioning the entire program.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we would look forward to having those conversations with you. It is very difficult, and what we heard from the participants over the course of the summer was particularly going to school and then doing some of the compliance requirements that are required under the work participation rate simply adds burden to them. And so that's one of the things that we're hoping that we can discuss, is not having people just jump through hoops because of compliance requirements. And you're correct. The challenge for people pursuing education, particularly 4-year degrees, is very difficult.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the thing that this brings up for me, when we're talking about these young parents, are we only coming into contact with them with the TANF program, I assume, after they've had the child? Am I right? I mean, assuming it's not their second child. And you're nodding yes. And the reason I'm asking that is I'm very interested in a program to intervene in fetal alcohol syndrome, which, of course, involves home visiting with at-risk moms during the pregnancy. And I'm seeing in your sheet here that this is families with high levels of need related to poverty or to chemical dependency. So I'm just wondering if there's an interaction there. I know there are such programs around the state. I know in my county, Olmsted County, they have what's known as the CRAP program. It's run by a small nonprofit. They've had phenomenal success rates with home visiting with chemically dependent moms during their pregnancy and some small period of time afterwards, after the delivery of the child. But it seems like there's a good synergy and intersection here, and I wonder if you could talk about that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lee, I'm actually going to ask Deb Schlick, who's also with us on the MFIP program, who I think can better answer that question.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, I'm Deborah Schlick. I work with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. So the intent of the initiative that Assistant Commissioner Sullivan Sutton explained was that a partnership between a local public health agency's home visiting program and a local county's MFIP program. And we want to invite willing counties and public health agencies into collaboration. And on the health side, Minnesota Department of Health really wants to emphasize that it be evidence-based home visiting services that would be employed. And one of the models they're using around the state nurse-family partnership puts a strong priority on reaching a woman while she's still pregnant. And so we hope by setting up that partnership that their outreach and engagement efforts, we can find out how successfully they are at connecting with these young moms and at what point. So we'll be learning some of that through those local collaboratives.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Ms. Sullivan Sutton. Regarding the impacts on the MFET program, it says that on the page 17, that one of the impacts expected is that performance measures, so among the outcomes positively impacted by these investments are improved employment outcomes for parents and improved high school graduation rates amongst teen parents. So I'm curious, is that just the impacts regarding this budget, this governor's budget, or has that been the impact since the inception of MFET or maybe in the last decade or so? And I have a follow-up question if that's permittable.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, that is our projections based on what the governor is proposing, that we focus on the work outcomes through the self-support index. In the past, much of the success of the MFIT program has really been around the work participation rates and meeting federal compliance requirements so that we don't lose any of the federal Temporary Assistance to Needy Families block grant. So this is a renewed emphasis on outcomes and a new focus on teen parents.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Well, I think I certainly recognize the importance, and most of those, I think we all do on the committee, I hear the emphasis on a four-year degree. I would hope that perhaps the department will, Harry, if you could, I want to, thank you. Thanks. I hope that the department and that we can help perhaps work with businesses in Minnesota, because there's a demand, a great demand for employment in trades and skills to learn to work with your hands. Not everybody has the needs a four-year degree. It's a lot expensive. It's a lot of time. These folks are raising their family. But great companies in our state need good skilled laborers that pay good wages, sometimes up to six figures. So perhaps you're already doing that. If not, maybe you can help us encourage and foster that employment, because there's a vast resources there, and I think the business community would be on board. I would hope they'd be, we'd encourage them to be on board to help foster that kind of climate, because there's a great void, a chasm for the good skilled labor. What say you regarding this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, absolutely. One of the things that I didn't talk about, we can give you some more information on, is a lot of work that we're doing with DEED, the Department of Employee and Economic Development, and regarding getting people to jobs, and something that we call Fast Track. And it really is that skills-based training, a combination of learning and skills that is showing very promising results. And in fact, I believe in the governor's budget there's some recommendations for expanding resources for those jobs programs.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Yeah. Okay. Pardon? One last thing.
One last. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
We're
you.
Going to have to move ahead, though.
Okay, we'll move fast. I'll talk really quick. Then perhaps would you visit, you and I can get together and talk about that further and work through the counties, of course, the closest to the people with the businesses, and those who need it are great. And then the second part of my question regarding the family visits, is there, what mechanisms are in place that the person from the county that is visiting these teen parents, what are the, some of the things that they're required to do to help these folks get off, of course, and up on their feet and back to school and back to work and get off of MFIT, so 75% of them or three-quarters of them don't go back? What mechanisms are in place to help them be good parents and good stewards of their family and then get a good education and jobs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, what we're hoping to do is replicate some of the early pilot work that has been done, for example, in Ramsey County, and now Hennepin County is doing something in this area. So rather than having a jobs counselor be the primary point of contact for a teen parent, that we would change that to have a nurse family home visitor as the primary point of contact and engage and support that teen parent, as well as hold the teen parent accountable for doing what they need to do to stay in school and safely care for and nurture their children. So this is a new approach with teen parents that we're hoping to try in a couple of counties, and then to learn and evaluate whether we can make a difference both in terms of the outcome for the teen parent as well as the children in that family.
Thank you. Last question.
Okay.
I should never say last question. I sound like Representative Grunhagen. Okay. Do you currently use nonprofit groups, civic groups, church groups to help with those members in our communities that need the help for home visiting?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that may vary by community. The home visiting dollars that are currently allocated are allocated through the Department of Health, and depending on the programs, they may be nurse home visiting. In other areas of the state, there may be different paraprofessionals that are part of that. But we could certainly ask that you get some more follow-up information about different paraprofessionals that are part of that. But we could certainly ask that you get some more follow-up information about that program from Health.
Thank you. I think that would be a wonderful idea, Mr. Chairman, because we have a the greatest generation is retiring now, the baby boomers, and they're young, they're experienced. Well, young, they're in their 60s and 70s. That's young. The 70s, the new 60. And they have such vast experience and knowledge. They could, and they're looking for things to do for the community. They want to give back. And a volunteerism, saving costs and sharing that knowledge and wisdom with young teens. Let's tap into that.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Aaron, I have a question. You know, with 75% of teen parents on the MFIP program, does it affect their benefits and I'm assuming in most cases it's a woman with a small child. If she marries her husband, does his income affect her level of benefits versus if she's just living together with that man? Is there any impact?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's the same. It's the household income, as I understand it, that is counted in determining eligibility.
So just a follow-up clarification. So if she's living with somebody, his income counts against her benefits?
Yep. That's correct.
Okay.
We're going to have to move along because we have one more to go, one more testifier.
Moving very quickly on to the next item, the Expand the Parent Support Outreach Program statewide. This is an early intervention program designed to reduce abuse and neglect. This is a recommendation to expand statewide this program that began as a pilot in 2005. This is an outreach, a voluntary outreach that is made to families who are reported for child protection, but on that given day, their family situation is not bad enough to come into the child protection door. What we see in Minnesota is about 17,000 families are reported to child protection a year because of concerns about child safety, abuse, neglect, and about 38,000 families are reported but screened out of the system. What we saw in the parent support outreach pilot, which had a rigorous evaluation, is for those families who are reported but screened out are oftentimes as at risk, if not greater risk, than families who come into the system. But if those families are offered are contacted, and there's an engagement with that family and an offer of services, for those families who receive services, they are in fact better off than similarly situated families who do not receive services. And what we saw through the pilot is that many of these people were single parents, oftentimes having issues with mental health needs or chemical health needs, or just simply needs in terms of meeting their family's basic needs. What we saw is that families who were approached without the threat of losing their child or child protection, they availed themselves of services. There's about a 50% uptake on service offerings, and about two-thirds of the families who were part of the pilot reported that they were significantly better off for having received the service. And so this recommendation is that there be an appropriation to allow for a statewide expansion of this program that's proven to be highly effective.
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair.
And we're gonna have to go a little over.
So, thank you. So, again, I think this is a great program of preventing, you know, abuse and neglect and maltreatment in homes and giving families the support they need before it happens. But I think in my other committee, Housing Committee, I heard Steve Vonderhart state that you will be expanding this program, one, which is really, really good. But a majority of services are in the rural community. And my hope is that as you begin to expand, and since we know a lot of times, you know, Native American, African American are disproportionately represented in the system, that you will be able to connect with more community organizations in those communities to give families the support they need to keep families together.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moran, we are certainly encourage counties to use community providers. We see that happening more in the metro area where there are community providers. We also have one pilot that's focusing specifically on early intervention with American Indian families, and hope to have results of that very soon. So if there's not further questions, I'll go very quickly. The next three items are actually recommendations for reductions. The first is a recommendation that would eliminate the 4-cent fee paid to grocers for the electronic benefit transfer card transactions made under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Currently, Minnesota grocers who use their own point-of-sale terminals rather than those supplied by the state receive a 4-cent fee for every SNAP transaction they process. And the fee originated many years ago when we were first looking at implementing an electronic benefit transaction system, and so that was a very new concept. And so the idea was to encourage and supplement retailers to accept to offer an alternative payment. With the current payment technology and consumer practices, we believe that the fee is no longer required to have an incentive for retailers to participate in having an electronic a capacity for transactions. Over the years, most states have stopped paying the fee. We're one of a few states who continue to do so. The monthly amount that the state pays to retailers has increased significantly with the growth in the SNAP program. We currently pay about $455,000 per year, and about 55% of that is state share. And so that recommendation is that we eliminate that fee. If not, the next item is simply an adjustment to the adoption assistance forecast. And this, the governor is recommending capturing surplus dollars in that program simply as a result of reduced caseloads in the foster care system. So fewer children are coming on to the program than were anticipated. This does not change benefits for anybody. The next item is a recommendation from the governor that we seek a federal match on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Employment and Training Program, and that we seek the match based on existing state expenditures under the Child Care Assistance and Diversionary Work Program. We've claimed these revenues in the past. The state gets approval from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for reimbursing us for current eligible expenditures. In 2012 and 2013, we requested and received approval from the federal government to claim these revenues. The current state authority that allows us to claim these funds expires at the end of the year, so we need the state's approval to allow us to continue to receive the federal funds that have already been approved.
Okay. I don't see any questions, so thank you, Commissioner, for your presentation.
Thank you.
And we'll move on to the last presenter, which is Dave Hartman from Assistant Commissioner of Chemical and Mental Health Services. Hartford. Sorry about that.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Dave Hartford, the Acting Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services. And this morning I will be covering 9 items, and primarily using the governor's change pages to walk through these items. And they start on page 18. There are also fast facts pages that I will not be following those numbers, but they're available for your reference. So in starting, I just wanted to address that, you know, through many administrations now, Minnesota has endeavored to move our public mental health system, our public behavioral health system, from institutional care to a more community-based, person-centered approach to all of our services. And with that in mind, this set of proposals really continues to help us move in that direction. And I'll start with, in total, through redirecting of funds, savings, and new investments, this package of nine bills has a net new increase in spending of $4 million of investments. It redirects $14 million and, in addition, returns $18 million to the general fund coming from the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. And I'll start with the first item, which is the governor recommends a doubling of our capacity for school mental health schooling grants. And again, that's on page 18. And that doubling will bring us from, currently we have 17% of our school districts covered by these grants, and we'd like to move to 35% of the grants. It's been a successful program as we've had it through these counties. The services in fiscal year 10 and 11, we served almost 14,000 children in these programs. 7,200 of these were their first contact with the mental health delivery system. 3,000 of these kids were from cultural minorities, and this was delivered at 840 school sites. The service is contracts with mental health professionals so they can provide billable services inside the schools, where it's a non-stigmatizing, it reduces the barriers to getting access to care for these kids, transportation, all of the issues that might ensue, and it also provides additional services that aren't billable services, such as consultation, care coordination, and promotion. We're asking for a new appropriation for this for $7.4 million for the biennium as a new investment. The outcome measures that we look for in this is the number of first-time users, number of schools providing the service, and the number of cultural minority students receiving mental health services. And I'll just kind of keep charging through.
Yes.
Mr. Chair. The next item on page 19 is provider reimbursement for clinical consultation. The governor recommends expanding provider reimbursement for time spent in clinical consultation to coordinate children's care through an MA benefit. And this is a shift where we will be using professionals, the care plan, if you will, to the family, as opposed to we'll be diverting psychotherapy billing to a clinical consultation that will permit the provider to meet with the family members, share the treatment plan, create interventions so that treatment plan is actually extended into the households. We're leveraging the family members as part of the care plan. It's been found to be very effective. We create a financial incentive. We move this, continue as MA benefit, create this as an MA benefit, and we create this financial incentive to maintain this consistency across primary care, social services. The benefit would be, again, funded by redirecting $4 million currently used to fund a local share grant for children's targeted case management. Excuse me, I confused these two. This is around the clinical consultation, which is a shift from targeted case management. Currently, we have children's targeted case management, and we would be redirecting so the care provider would be directing the care. This would allow the individual to work with other agencies and extend the care plan to other agencies. So you, instead of having just a case manager directing the care, you would have the professional who creates the care plan. And the savings in this would be $694,000 in the biennium.
Well, Mr. Hartford, what you're going to do is pay people more, but it's actually going to save money.
It's going to save money, and the target for this is a reduction in the number of children with high-cost mental health conditions, as defined by children with over $50,000 in services. So, again, this is the focus. A focus of this is to reduce health care costs because this lack of coordination has been identified as one of the key drivers for high costs in health care.
And is there a privacy problem with sharing this information, you know, the mental health information for this child with the parents, or is that automatic anyway?
Mr. Chair, that would be coordinated with the family as to releases to share that information.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And I'm actually kind of happy to see this provision. We did some work about this under your previous watch, trying to go after these high-cost cases. The youth special kids did some physical stuff, and then we thought if we expanded it to the mental health side, it would work. And see, it just took 3 or 4 years for great ideas to percolate back to the surface. So.
Mr. Hartford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I apologize for confusing it with this next item, which is the establishment of a family psychoed benefit. The governor recommends repurposing existing funding for the psychotherapy benefit to instead be used for psychoeducation benefit. This allows the provider to work with the family members to learn skills needed to support their child's treatment. We know that it's cost-effective extension of the care. This is funded by a redirection of the use of the psychotherapy benefit. So the provider will reduce the amount of psychotherapy being used and redirect those funds for education for the family so that we can really leverage those family members in supporting the child. Performance measures for this is completing a rollout with the providers, because it's a new service, we need to establish a baseline and increase the number of mental health professionals who successfully complete training on delivery, documentation, and billing. And the next item is mental health crisis services. The governor recommends expanding mental health crisis response services to an additional 16 counties and two tribes. Currently, we have crisis services for 59 of our counties for adults, 49 counties for children, and only one tribe. This service helps individuals that are experiencing a mental health crisis, either in their homes or in the community, to be served rather than a more restrictive environment like an emergency room or having law enforcement involved in the mental health emergency. It brings mental health professionals to serve anytime, any place. Crisis services are a covered MA benefit today, and we're looking for an investment of $2 million for the biennium, and this is for four startup costs for teams for adults and children across these 16 additional counties and tribes. The performance measure that we look for in this is to reduce the rate of suicide, hospitalization, and law enforcement involvement. Next item is an adjustment in the adult rehabilitative mental health service. The governor recommends adjusting adult rehabilitative mental health services payment rate and provisions of service. ARMS are in a foundational set of services that help keep people in the community and out of the hospital. The rate structure has not changed since 2006. And what we're finding is we've lost more than 10% of our ARMS providers saying that they can't meet the cost of delivering the service is more expensive than the reimbursement. And we also have many more providers dropping different provisions of service because they're unable to make it. So one aspect of this is to adjust rates. The other aspect is to add some additional provisions of care. Such as functional assessments, clinical supervision, and transportation costs. In 2011, we served approximately 14,000 individuals with ARMS services that helped keep them in their homes. There would be no net change in budget for this item. It will be funded by repurposing from either the Adult Integrated Fund or the Community Support Fund. The measure of performance that we look for in this and that we've demonstrated in the past is a reduction in mental health inpatient days. Questions?
Continue.
Next item is a mental health specialty treatment service. The governor recommends establishing a pilot program for a 24/7 medically monitored mental health specialty treatment service. This pilot is the beginning of, we've addressed a gap in the mental health delivery system, and that's for individuals who really have complex needs, they're in an inpatient setting, and there's a gap between that inpatient setting and a residential program, another setting in the community as we stand today. So what happens is they end up staying in the inpatient units for extended periods of time because they're not able to step down, if you will. What's needed is a medically monitored system where the physician, the medical provider stay involved at that kind of next level because they're still complex. Without this service, we continue to clog our system and create significant impact on our psychiatric bed availability because we're misusing those valuable inpatient beds. The program would be licensed and funded as an intensive residential treatment service, an existing MA benefit, with $2 million for the biennium, funded by the SOS special revenue account. This account is collections from SOS intensive residential programs would fund that incremental piece. And again, this is a pilot. We recognize other populations in the future may benefit from this level of service also. The performance measure for this pilot would be to reduce the number of non-acute bed days at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. And again, relatively small number of people needing this service, but it cost the system significant number of dollars and lack of access.
And if they're in a regional treatment center, we do not get medical assistance.
That's correct. That's correct, Mr. Chair. next item is around screening, brief intervention, referral, and treatment, known as ESPERT. This is an evidence-based practice that allows physicians to do screening, complete a brief intervention, and referral to treatment. It's the governor recommends funding training for primary care physicians to use ESPERT process to identify people at risk and to intervene and refer to treatment. This is asking for a new appropriation of $600,000 for the biennium. The measure is the number of primary care physicians trained in utilizing this evidence-based practice, for which there is a this is a reimbursable service as it's set up today. We just need to train physicians and get this into practice patterns. And then we have the elimination, page 21, elimination of alternatives to Moose Lake Grant. It's unfortunate this was named as, it's an unusual name for this. It comes from it's an operating subsidy grant that was initiated in 1995 with the closure of Moose Lake State Hospital to support hospitals and caring for people who might be civilly committed to the regional treatment centers. Since that time, it has spread, and we currently have 9 hospitals in the state that receive this operating subsidy. And it's part of a system. We have 18 hospitals in the state that receive the MA fee-for-service contract, which picks up an addition for hospitals serving civilly committed persons. These 18 hospitals may receive this MA fee-for-service contract. This operating subsidy, half of these 18 have the operating subsidy, and they're all in greater Minnesota. The metro hospitals never receive the subsidy. So this is an operating subsidy not attached to individual patients like the MA fee-for-services. So it's just an operating subsidy that these 9 hospitals receive, and it is funded by a biennial appropriation that goes to the hospitals. So the recommendation is to end that subsidy for those 9 hospitals.
Just an announcement. We're going to go until 2:45, and then we're going to have to adjourn. And if you could come back, Mr. Hartford, tomorrow, we have scheduled time that will allow about 20 minutes for you to finish up, and then we'll go on to House File 9 after that tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, I have one more item and then questions. So I'll take the last item, which the governor recommends a one-time transfer of unspent funds in the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Fund to the general fund. This was due to a lower than forecasted spending over the last few years. In fiscal year 11, there was a $13 million balance forward. Fiscal year 12, we now have $18 million balance forward. So this is looking for authorization to sweep this budgetary fund balance to the general fund.
Okay, so does that complete your...
That completes my 9 items.
Okay. Because there are some more, I see, that relate to regional treatment centers. So.
And those would be, I believe, Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry will handle those.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Hartford? When is the department going to have its, class 4 drugs, I'm thinking of methadone plus the other one, so you're going to have a proposal on that? Does that cost money, or is it a policy?
Mr. Chair, that will be policy bills around coming from licensing.
Okay. Huge. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Hartford, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.